Now, it's under that sacrificial pit that this ramp that an important document called the Copper Scroll was placed, which I'll come back to. And it was concealed beneath a marble block with a brass hoop. And in every Masonic lodge, there is a suspended marble block with a brass hoop. Now, after the crucifixion, James saw the wisdom of his brother's ways. He saw that it was the only way that it was going to work to bring everyone together. And he started adopting the same approach. He became the first bishop of Jerusalem, the Mabaka, as he was called, and he took to wearing a mitre, exactly as a bishop's mitre would be today. And the reason for that is that if we look at an Egyptian hieroglyph for the god Amun-Ra, the creator god of Thebes, we see he looks exactly like a bishop with a mitre, with a crucifix, which is actually an ankh, in his hand, and the flowing robes. That was an Egyptian hieroglyph. So, once again, showing that there was a strong connection with the theology of Jerusalem to the theology used in Thebes, nowhere else, which has never been focused on before. And our work has created a lot of interest amongst biblical scholars to study that connection a lot more closely. Now, James became the undisputed leader of the Jerusalem church after that point, and that is accepted by just about all biblical scholars now. Not Peter, but James. But then a character arrived on the scene called Saul. Now, Saul was his original name, and we're told that he changed it to Paul after he had this conversion on the road to Damascus. Well, that's not the case. He changed his name from the Hebrew name Saul as a very young man to the Roman name Paul when he became a Roman citizen. Paul is a Roman name, and he wanted a name that sounded like his original Hebrew name. So in actual fact, it was the reverse, that he changed his name to become a Roman and to spend his time persecuting the Jews, the Jewish church. Now many people have Professor Eisenman in California, as a leading light in the subject, have identified Paul as the spouter of lies referred to in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the person that did great battle with James. And Paul certainly admitted that he's a liar, because he says in the New Testament, I made myself a Jew to the Jews to win the Jews. To those who have no law, I was free of the law myself. I made myself all things to all men. That is how I run, intent on winning. That is how I fight, not beating the air. So he admits, I'll say anything to get my own way. So that's pretty close to admitting that he is a spouter of lies. Now, he had a great conflict with James. At one point, Paul had to be rescued from a riot where he was about to be lynched by Romans after a conflict with James. In the Turkish city of Ephesus, he was imprisoned for his own safety, for the things that he was saying, because he claimed to have a divine revelation straight from God to him that told him that Jesus Christ, the brother of James, was a god. And James said, "What? My brother wasn't a god." So he didn't come from anywhere other than his own mind. Paul invented the idea that Jesus was a god. Last Saturday, I was talking to a Roman Catholic priest colleague who is also a scholar, and he said, "It's just ridiculous. Obviously, Paul completely invented the whole thing, and the church has got off to a bad start from the beginning, because it just could not have been that way." Now, James was a very popular man, the teacher of righteousness, and the crucifixion took place somewhere in the mid-30s AD, and James was killed in 62 AD. He too was killed. He was thrown supposedly from the temple walls, and hit with a fuller's club, which caused him injuries, which just happened to be identical to those of Sekou Henry Tau. So we imagine, actually, that that is not literally the case. It's probably a pesha, as the Hebrews called it, to identify the two occasions, to identify James with the legend of Sekou Henry Tau. But he was killed, and that caused the beginnings of the war that was to break out in 66 AD between the Romans and the Jews. Now, an early church father wrote, he was rather confused, because it was often said that the war started because of James, and he wrote, although, in regard to Josephus, although not believing in Jesus as the Christ, Josephus, when researching for the true cause of the fall of Jerusalem, ought to have said that the persecution of Jesus was the cause of the ruin, because the people had killed the prophesied Messiah. Yet, as if against his will, and not far from the truth, he says that this befell the Jews in revenge for Jacob the Just, James the Just, who was the brother of Jesus, the so-called Christ, because they killed him, although he was a perfectly just man. So the early church fathers couldn't quite work this out, that everyone was, Josephus said that the war started because of the killing of James, and they thought, no, it must have been Jesus, they must have got that wrong. But he didn't get it wrong. James adopted the teachings of his brother about equality, democracy, if you like. Everyone had to be part of the whole, which were quite revolutionary ideas. Now, the war broke out in 66 AD, and it was a terrible war. There were Jews killing Jews, Romans killing Jews, people dying all over the place. And it went quite well at first, and they defended Jerusalem quite successfully. But it was a war they were never going to win. The might of the Roman Empire was always going to defeat this small country. But of course they believed that Yahweh would come fire-breathing and just blast away the enemy. They were a passionate, inspired people, rather than a mechanistic and logical people, as the Romans may well be described. But in 68 AD, Qumran was destroyed, the place where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. But those scrolls found in Qumran that are so important really are just the shopping lists and the tittle-tattle. The really important documents had to be buried beneath the Temple in Jerusalem, as close to the Holy of Holies as it is possible. And the copper scroll that was found at Qumran, so-called, because it's made of copper, is like a treasure list. It says where things are buried all over the place. And it identifies that in the sacrificial pit, the blood-collecting pit beneath the altar in Jerusalem, is a copy of this same scroll, which contains even more information. And it identifies that there are in total 24 scrolls buried beneath the temple in Jerusalem that belong to that community, their most important scrolls, along with a huge amount of treasure, coins, gold and silver objects, vessels used in the holy rituals in the temple. A vast, vast amount of wealth was buried there. Because they were looting the whole of the countryside, they were taking things from the Romans as well as their own possessions, and they buried everything there, because they knew if everything else fell, the temple would not, because Yahweh would never allow that to happen. Unfortunately, Yahweh did allow that to happen, because in 70 AD Titus destroyed the city. He tried not to, he wanted to preserve it, so it is said. But it was utterly destroyed, because they fought desperately to the end, but the Holy of Holies itself was destroyed. Many of the defending Jews went underground into the tunnels and caverns to re-emerge to fight again if they could. But in that war that happened between 66 and the last remnants probably around 74-75 AD, virtually the entire population of the Holy Land was destroyed, were killed, men, women and children. According to Josephus, 1.3 million people. That's an awful lot of people in those days. Now, it's rather interesting that the New Testament, which is obviously fixated by the arrival of its new Messiah and his people, doesn't even notice that all of them were killed. The writings cease in about 66 AD, the writings of Paul, and the earliest dating for Mark, the first of the Gospels, is around 75. So this stopped during that period of the war, and no one noticed that everyone was killed. Now, the problem was that the people then who had to write down the history of Jesus and the goings-on in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus the Christ had no first-hand knowledge. In fact, they had no second-hand knowledge. They had, at best, third-hand knowledge. And they were people from the empire rather than Jerusalem Jews that understood the real mindset. Because at that time, the only place a Jew could worship was at the temple. Now, the idea of synagogues was just sort of starting in the empire, but they were not places of worship, they were places of gathering together. So they had bags of opportunity to misunderstand the terms resurrection and turning water into wine. They had a sort of a Hellenistic outlook, which is quite different. And they converted into their sort of mystery cults that were so popular in Rome at the time. And there was a complete loss of the original truths. Now, we believe that the rituals that they used, that the history of the Jerusalem church were recorded in documents that were buried under the temple and they were placed there. So it's known by scholars that Matthew, Mark and Luke based their gospels on a previous document, a previous gospel, which is known just as simply as Q. That gospel of Q is or was under the temple of Herod. So we start to have a good grip on what was buried there. There's hard documentary evidence when and why and how documents were buried there. We know that the British Royal Engineers went there in the last century, didn't find any documents or treasures. All they found were remnants of the Knights Templar. So the conclusion seems to be inescapably that the Knights Templar removed what was there. Now, the Knights Templar, we couldn't work out why they had gone excavating beneath the temple. Maybe they were just looking for treasure. Maybe they were looking for the Ark of the Covenant. Who knows? They thought it was Solomon's temple. They didn't realize it was Herod's temple, some people say. But shortly after they were founded, the rumors were going around that they were conducting strange rituals, that they were heretical, that they denied Christ. All sorts of rumors were going around. And as I mentioned earlier, they survived from their official founding in 1128 through to 1307, when they were finally destroyed as heretics. Whatever it was they found, they would have to keep secret, because there wouldn't be time to explain before they were burnt at the stake. The church did not welcome new information. They'd gone to great lengths to make sure that information wasn't available. The library at Alexandria was burnt to the ground. Any heretical documents, i.e. anything that wasn't officially recognized, were destroyed. Heretics were destroyed. They had things under control. So these nine founding knights knew that they had to keep them very quiet. And their first preceptory that they built outside of the Holy Land was built in Scotland, just south of Edinburgh, which is extremely significant, and I'll come back onto shortly. Now, when they were arrested, by Philip IV, Philip the Fair of France. The Holy Land had been lost by the beginning of the 1300s. Their glorious past was a memory, and the Pope was allegedly trying to amalgamate the Order of the Hospitallers with the Templars and have a single outfit. And Jacques de Molay, the last Grand Master, was summoned to come to Paris. The fact is that Philip IV of France was bankrupt and he needed money desperately. And he knew that the Templars were phenomenally rich and he wanted their treasury. He'd had huge loans from them in the past. And he conspired, well, in 1306, the year before, he'd conspired to rob every Jew in France. He just suddenly announced that all Jewish possessions should be seized and they should be exiled, which is a very convenient way of getting large amounts of money. And fortunately, that's been done to the Jews a number of times before. But that still wasn't enough money, so he decided to grab the Templar money. And he had evidence of their rituals and their beliefs. So it was going to be relatively easy for him to justify seizing it. And on that day, on Friday the 13th of October 1307, they moved against the Templars and arrested them en masse all across France. In the Paris Temple, Jacques de Molay was seized. Now, the Templar fleet had been brought into La Rochelle harbour. But sometime on that Thursday night before the Friday morning, they slipped away, they disappeared. The secrecy had been kept pretty well by the French, but they'd missed a trick. Somebody had heard something and they just were no longer there. The whole fleet was just gone. And it was never seen again. Although their battle flag was seen again. A battle flag was a skull and crossbones. Just as in a Masonic lodge, the skull and crossbones are on the floor. And we believe they sailed, well, part of the fleet sailed to Scotland and part of the fleet sailed to Portugal, just a little way down, because Portugal was very sympathetic to them, as was Scotland. And they restocked and they sailed exactly due west in search of a star called America. Being a French order, it was called L'America. And they found the land across the sea, the ocean to the west. And they landed there at least the early weeks of 1308. Maybe they'd been there before as well. And they called the land America, where everything was wonderful. And they settled there. There is evidence. There is the Newport Tower in Rhode Island, which is identifiable as a medieval Templar round building. And there is what is known as the Westford Knight, a carving, a tombstone believed to be of a knight by the name of Gunn, who was buried at the time. So there is evidence of Templar existence in what is now the United States of America. There is also evidence in Scotland that the Templars were trading with America before Columbus. And that is the building of Roslyn Chapel, which I'll come onto in a moment, which has carved into it the lower cactus. It has maize, American corn, carved into it, and numerous other plants, which are New World plants. And that building was built between 1440 and completed in 1490. So in the middle 1400s, they were carving in plants which are uniquely from this continent. And of course, good old Columbus didn't land until 1492. And then that was not the mainland at all. So there is a problem with the idea of Columbus discovering America. And we, considering that there is cocaine in the mummies found in ancient Egypt, there's a lot of problems with the idea of Columbus. Since writing our first book, we've been contacted by lots of people who've got information for us. A multi-millionaire Norwegian shipping magnate informed him many things, but he also said that there are records in the city of Bristol that have got the logs of ships that sailed trading with North America before Columbus sailed. The documents are still there. There was a bishopric that the church in Rome actually had a bishop with responsibility for Newfoundland. So there is a huge amount of problem with it. Now, we believe that it's called America because it was La America, named after the star, the Venus setting in the west. The conventional idea, of course, it was that it was Amerigo Vespucci, that it was named after him. But that's a well-known error because that was a monk called Waldseemüller who was fascinated by words and numbers and names, and he loved playing with them. And he had, unfortunately, one of the first printing presses in the world. And he worked out that America must be called that because Amerigo Vespucci, who was very insignificant, very late, and didn't sail very much anyway. And he got it wrong, but he printed it. And the power of the printed word did its worst for the first time in history. He soon was told, hey, you've got that wrong. And he thought, oh my God, what shall I do? And he tried to retrieve everything, but he couldn't. He tried to retract, but he couldn't. So the idea that America is called after Amerigo Vespucci is just not true. So, the knights that went to Scotland, they went there for one very good reason, and that is that Robert the Bruce was king of the Scots at the time, and he was excommunicated. So there was no power of the Pope to get at them in Scotland. That was one reason. The other reason was that their principal estates were in Scotland. They were fundamentally, you recall, a French order, but they made their really important estates in Scotland. They built all across Europe. All the great medieval cathedrals were built by the Templars. They were building the New Jerusalem everywhere across Europe. But we had read about this Roslin Chapel in Scotland, as it's called, built in, begun in 1440, that had these plants carved into it. And so Robert and I drove up there to have a look at it. But when we got there, we realised that there was much, much more significance than just that.